From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made yesterday afternoon at the Islamic Center of Rochester. Hundreds of people of various faiths and backgrounds gathered to support the local Muslim community following the terrorist attack in New Zealand that killed 50 people. As my colleague April Franklin reported, some of the people who attended were not particularly religious themselves, but found it vital to show solidarity. They held signs that read, "We will stand watch while you pray." The gathering in Rochester was one of hundreds across the country and around the world this past weekend. Mourners have asked what they can do as true allies, what that really means. We'll explore that question this hour. In New Zealand, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern revealed that President Donald Trump called her to ask what he and the United States could do to help following the tragedy. Ardern said, quote, "My message was, show sympathy and love for all Muslim communities," end quote. The president has denied that white supremacy is on the rise in the United States or worldwide, and he has continually criticized Islam while seeking to ban Muslims from entering this country. Let's talk about what it means to show solidarity in practice and what we do going forward, and frankly, how this attack has resonated here and around the world. Our guests in studio include Ulmer Hodzik. Oh, Alma, I'm so sorry. Alma is an activist and a refugee from Bosnia. Been on this program before. It's always great to have you. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
Also with us is Iman Abid, who's an activist and a Muslim American. Welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
Sarir Fazli is the immediate past president of the Islamic Center of Rochester. Welcome back to you as well, Sarir.
Nice to be here, Evan. Thank you.
I want to ask all three of you just to start by letting us know how this tragedy, how this act of terrorism has resonated in our community and in your own lives. And I'll start with Iman.
For me, it unfortunately was no surprise. That I think was one of the most unfortunate things. Whether or not the plot itself was necessarily a surprise and how it was done, I was more so taken aback by the level of thought taken into the plot attack itself, knowing that this terrorist, identified this community of people during Jumu'ah prayer, during Friday prayer, because of their vulnerability and their backs to the doors. I knew that he, with his live stream of the video and all of that being done, that he intentionally wanted to hurt the community. He really wanted to start forming a divide and sort of develop this sort of like mistrust. And that to me, I think the steps that were taken to get to that attack itself were more surprising than the attack itself. But to say that I was surprised is an understatement. I'm not surprised.
Hmm. Alma?
Unfortunately, just like with any terrorist attack, you're dealing with the first shock of what has happened and how many innocent people have been killed. And then from that, you move on to the fact that this was done during a prayer service. And one of the most cherished things that I really love about this country is religious freedom. So to me, that's something that's shocking. And then for me personally, a trauma of a Bosnian genocide survivor kicked in, because one of the things that I started hearing is that this man was actually influenced by the Serb nationalism that was now connected to the white supremacy. And as someone who has lived through the terrible catastrophe of the Bosnian genocide, that was something that I spent 3 days just mourning the community, but mourning the fact that someone is using this to build on to white supremacy, and that's a scary thought.
Sarir?
Evan, Muslim communities across the world have been victims of terror before, and whether they were victims of terror from their own / Muslim hands or non-Muslim hands, the fact is this isn't the first time and it's probably not going to be the last. What's an encouraging sign, however, is how the other communities, at least within America, I don't know what happened outside, took the lead in, for the first time perhaps, sticking up for Muslims as victims. When we saw those anti-Muslim bans and travel bans and admission bans and whatnot, so many of our friends from other religious and social communities came out to the forefront for us and stood up for us. I wasn't here yesterday, but from what I understand, it was the interfaith community and the Jewish community that said, we're doing this. And that kind of a statement, that kind of a stand, it brings us some pride and some hope that as these things continue to happen, we have a lot of ammunition in our own guns, so to speak, to dispel and dissuade people from continuing to have thoughts that they may have had that encouraged this guy in the first place from having.
Well, I wonder if the other guests agree with that. Did you at least feel that strength of solidarity this past weekend, Iman?
Yeah, I was overwhelmed approaching the mosque, you know, at the Islamic Center of Rochester yesterday. I was so overwhelmed by the number of people who were standing at the entrance of the parking lot and then the people blocking the entrance itself just due to how large of a crowd there was. And I was also astonished at not only the different faith communities that showed up, but also those who weren't a part of a faith community that also showed up. And the crowds themselves are starting to get younger and younger. There's such a wide range of people. It's very intergenerational as far as to who's responding to these attacks. And I think it's because of the level of pain it's really caused so many different communities. I mean, when I think back to how I first fell back on Friday, right after I had heard about all these incidents, and, you know, it happened in more than just one mosque, I started to think to myself, you know, what was the response like back during the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh? What was it like in Parkland? And, you know, what is it like now with all the incidents that have also popped up, even following the shootings out in Christchurch? And I acknowledge that the communities have constantly turned up and the crowds are continuing to get larger and larger. And I think it's because we're starting to empathize more so with one another. I don't think we can watch each other kind of taking this on alone. And I think it's really important that we have that interfaith community. And I think Rochester is incredible with as far as response goes. And I really just want to take the time to thank everybody who took the time out of their day, their holy day, you know, to stand with us and to keep us secure as we prayed. And even while we were in the prayer room, for those of us, you know, I was in the women's section of the Islamic Center, and having everybody around, you know, behind me, I couldn't help but cry while I was praying. I was praying our afternoon prayer, and I couldn't help but cry thinking that I have a crowd full of people here who are trying to protect me. And this is all, you know, and I didn't realize how important that was, is just to show up and to stand up with one another. I am absolutely amazed by the turnout and solidarity.
Alma, do you agree?
My daughter was greeted yesterday as we were entering into the masjid with a goodie bag from a Jewish girl who was there to show support. There's not many places in the world where you can see that, and that was exactly what my family and what my daughter really needed yesterday. And I loved that, and I'm really thankful to the Jewish community, to the Mormon community, and all of the other community and also I have found out that the University of Rochester actually sent an email encouraging the staff to actually show up yesterday. That's amazing. That is amazing, and we are really grateful.
Powerful testimonials. Listeners, as we go throughout the hour, if you want to share feedback, you can call the program if you like. You can email the program connections@wxxi.org. And before the program began, Sarir Fazali was making a point that I'm going to ask him to touch on, which is, you know, trying to understand how anyone could do something like this and where it starts. And, you know, I mean, I think that we have to be a little careful in spots like this because we want to understand. You look at this, you know, you're sort of exasperated. How in the hell is this happening anywhere in the world to any community? What is it that leads someone down this path? And yes, the shooter whose name I haven't mentioned, and I wrestle with that, how much you report names and faces, how much you don't. But yes, had a manifesto, and Kellyanne Conway, advisor to the president, is urging people to read the manifesto. So I want to start by asking our guests, do you agree with that? Should people read that, Iman?
No, I think it comes out of this fake crisis that immigrants are trying to come into your own country to replace white people. I think that's what the essential, you know, the very basic principles of the manifesto actually are. So why should we be spending time investing in that when we should be really understanding where these people are actually coming from and why they're actually trying to seek refuge in our own countries? I think, you know, knowledge is power, and really acknowledge. I'm not going to say that, you know, I'm never going to deter somebody from reading something, but I think at the same time, I think it's that's not where we need to invest our resources and our time. It's time to think about why people are coming here. Why are they seeking out on a journey that can sometimes be so incredibly deadly to try to seek refuge in another country that is completely unknown to them? And I think, again, what we saw in New Zealand reminded me a lot of what our president has been saying as far as to what this national crisis is that supposedly exists at the border, you know, with, people coming in from Mexico and other places as well. And, you know, there's a number of people who have come forward and said that this is not a real crisis. This is not a real national emergency that we actually need to invest dollars into to build a wall so that we can actually make sure that these people are not coming into our country. And we see the level of hate that's coming in against those people. We see the treatment that's been made at the border itself through, you know, the various tactics that Border Patrol is being told to use by the federal administration that are incredibly inhumane, whether it's a separation of families, whether it's actually the abuses that are ongoing within the border if people are being detained. And again, even some of the deaths that have been caused, you know, there was a young Guatemalan girl that was, you know, died in the hands of custody of Border Patrol because she was being mistreated. And it just reminds me, yeah, again, that there's just this lack of understanding as to why people are trying to enter the United States or enter other countries where they're trying to seek refuge.
Hmm. Alma, do you want anyone to read the manifesto?
Unfortunately, I have seen some very unfortunate responses from the highest level of leadership in this country. And unfortunately, for example, from Australia, where basically the Muslims are being blamed for the actual attack. So having said that, you know, I'm looking on the other side with the Prime Minister of New Zealand, this woman who has shown an amazing leadership quality. This is one of the youngest, and I'm so proud that she's actually a woman. She was 37 when she was elected to be Prime Minister of New Zealand. So I would say that I hope that our leadership is really paying attention how you're supposed to respond to hate and how you're supposed to comfort your community and all of your people.
Her name is Jacinda Ardern, the New Zealand Prime Minister. And just quoting from Reuters, she said, "It is clear that this can only be described as a terrorist attack," she said, saying that we should name it specifically. She said about the gunman, "You may have chosen us, but we utterly reject and condemn you." She said, quote, "We were not chosen for this act of violence because we condone racism, because we are an enclave for extremism. We were chosen for the very fact that we are none of these things, because we represent diversity, kindness, compassion, a home for those who share our values, refuge for those who need it. And those values, I can assure you, will not and cannot be shaken by this attack," end quote. Those are the words of the Prime Minister of New Zealand, who's, I say this not sort of in the tabloid way. Her star has risen because people around the world know her name because of her response to this. And you're saying it's moved you.
Absolutely. And there was something else that was said yesterday by one of the Muslim community members in New Zealand. And it really struck with me. And he said this is not, this is really separating people with a specific set of values. And this is not about, you know, the specific spot on earth. It is about the values that we share. And that, to me, was extremely important to be heard.
So, Sarir Fazli, do you want anyone to read that manifesto?
I don't think I want to censor that manifesto. But what I want to do is I, like every time we have an opportunity, is I want to use something like this as a teaching example. As I said to you earlier before we started, you know, when we try to teach our kids or discipline our kids, there's a boogeyman in the closet if you don't go to bed, or there are monsters under the bed. When we teach that and we say that, those kids then, when you tell them as they're getting older, there's no such thing as monsters or whatever, they say, hey, you told us there were monsters and now you're saying there's not. We create that fear. We create that whole paranoia about what's going on. Someone or someones are creating these paranoias in the minds of either youth or gullible adults or whomever and fostering this atmosphere. I can't imagine, I mean, on a international level, there's a lot of issues and episodes between countries and communities where they have come to blows and everybody has their own political issues. But taking aim at a faith community when you know they're at their most vulnerable and trying to eliminate them and live streaming it, I mean, that kind of planning takes some real thought. I don't want anybody to read about that and how this guy anticipated and planned and then acted upon it because now tomorrow someone else is going to try to do better. But at the same time, I want to get those people who may have an inkling or a weakness towards believing in that kind of behavior and try to use that, you know, poison to bring them back from the brink so that they can understand what's going on. There were protests and threats of violence against Muslims in Texas in the last year or three, and it got nasty and people were very scared. Man, some of those people who were willing to take actions and violence, act of violence against Muslims, they have come into that same mosque and Islamic centers in Texas and apologized. Some of them even converted. Now, I'm not asking anybody to do that. But at the same time, it tells you that given the opportunity in some calm, with some direction and control of what we're talking about, we can have a conversation. And you can tell me why you think I'm a monster, and I can try to tell you why I think you're misguided and I'm not. And hopefully we meet somewhere so that there's an understanding. And I think that it's these episodes, whether it was Muslim on Muslim or non-Muslim on Muslim, these are the episodes we're seeing. When people talk about a change in the age demographic of people that are coming out to support and protest, it proves my point to an extent. The younger people with more education, more opportunity, more exposure to people that generally you or I may not have known or been exposed to, they're getting that exposure. And they are the ones who are taking the lead and saying, this isn't what you think it is. This has to stop because we know and we have the experience. I really think it's an educational opportunity, and it gives us a chance to expose people a little differently.
I want you to help us with something, though, because when you talk about, you know, an adult in Texas who's going to walk into an Islamic center and either apologize or have a conversation, that's powerful, that's profound. But too often, if it is an adult with this form of an idea, it may be, it's not, actually, let me peel that back. I don't think it's ever too late. I don't think it's ever too late. But it is more difficult when it's an adult with a fully formed idea. The difference is in kids. What are we going to do? And sort of, here's where my brain goes this weekend. So, Sarir, yesterday, my son and I went to the Greece YMCA. We're playing basketball. And about 20 minutes in, I go, oh, my gosh, the guy who's shooting baskets with us is J-Mac. That's Jason McElwain, the guy who 13 years ago, his story goes super nuclear viral, you know, a student with autism who gets carried off the court. So, of course, I'm subtle about it, but I tell my son later, and we watch the ESPN story, mm-hmm. and I'm crying. And he's like, why are you crying? And I said, you know, listen, buddy, you're not even 7 years old yet, but this is a student who his classmates literally carried him off the court on their shoulders because they love him. They don't care if he is, quote unquote, different or whatever the case is. That's what love and acceptance is. That's what real allyship is. It's not just tolerance. It's not just, well, I'm going to live with you. It's loving. And I look at him, and it doesn't even occur to him that you wouldn't love everybody. But at some point, he's going to encounter people who give him ideas. And I've got work to do as a parent. We've got work to do. Well, we know that in parts of our country, Sarir, some of these ideas pick up more velocity than others. And I don't mean to overgeneralize, but there's surveys on this. You know, red and blue America have mm-hmm. very different views on Islam. Red and blue states are much more sort of self-segregated these days. What do we do with that, especially when kids who grew up just happy to play with and love with anybody by the time they're in high school might have already been kind of embedded with these ideas?
It's something that, you know, I think about often because my seven-year-old was watching the news yesterday and says to me, Daddy, what bad thing happened? And there wasn't even volume on the news at that time. They were just the pictures, and she read something. I have still faith in human nature. In my experience before I was in the leadership at the Islamic Center, during and even after, I have tremendous faith in people being able to take a step back, have a conversation, and then come to a decision. A week ago, I was a part of a conference at Nazareth College, and my session was on Islamophobia. And I had these kids from all across Western New York, all across the county, different schools, suburbs, urban, a little bit more rural. And I told them, I said, tell me how bad I am so that I can give you an example of why I'm not, or at least I can try to show you why that's the wrong opinion or attitude. I gave them some examples of some stuff I had been through in just in traveling and how I was treated. And they all had the same thing. Sir, we don't think you're bad at all. We think you may be a little misunderstood. And we think that, you know, people are making efforts to try to clear up that misunderstanding. But I had the most diverse group of kids from across the county and a little bit beyond. And I thought about it. I said, this is one heck of a start. I may not be able to get every egg before it cracks, but I'm going to get a few. And those are the ones that are going to lead the next generation. If it's not their parents, it's them. If it's not them, it might be their kids, because it's the exposure that they're getting to people of different faiths from different countries, that is going to help to solve this problem. You know, like I said, we all bring a lot of baggage when we come from overseas. I don't like somebody from this country, they don't like me or whatever. We come here, all of a sudden, it's a different game. We hear about a lot of stuff, and then when we see it opposite in practice, we realize, or we should realize, it's very hard not to see how the fabric of these communications and discussions in America take place without realizing that whatever baggage we may have had put into us at home or abroad, it doesn't really have any weight.
Alma, what can we do to kind of stop those seeds from growing?
Well, I have to say that yesterday before I went to the mosque for the because I knew this event was happening in support of the Muslims, I actually sat all three of my children and I had a talk with them. I often describe myself as a full-time volunteer. I am really involved in the community. I try to fight poverty, racism, Islamophobia, whatever it is, and I hope that I act in ways that actually shows my kids that, you know, any kind of hate is not okay. But I actually made it a point yesterday to sit them down in front of me and tell them it's not okay not to like anyone for whatever reason it is. And in this house, we teach love. And in this house, you know, we teach understanding, and in this house, we teach actually communication. It was extremely powerful for me yesterday when I was standing in the hallway of the Islamic Center, surrounded by all kinds of different people, to actually see a young Mormon girl who is one of my daughter's best friends actually come out of the crowd to hug me. And I told my daughter when I got home, I really am glad that you are choosing your friends wisely. And I hope that by my daughter being in the community and actually being exposed, and the community being exposed to my daughter and someone like you know, who wears a hijab, who is proudly Muslim American, that she is changing some narratives, and maybe she's forcing people to see, okay, well, these people are normal just like we are.
Iman.
I'm going to take a slightly different approach to how we can perhaps respond to this. And I think one of the things that I constantly want to acknowledge are the systems that allow and legitimize such hate and prejudice. I think it's really important, you know, to move beyond just, you know, blaming authoritative figures, whether it's our president or a prime minister of another country, of whomever it may be that we're speaking about, and acknowledging how it is that someone even came to rise in power within the systems that we are faced with. So when I'm thinking about the American democracy, and I'm thinking about our own rights, and I'm thinking about, you know, what are we actually willing to risk and sacrifice in the name of things like national security, and who is it at the cost of? And in most cases, it's at the cost of, you know, Arab, Middle Eastern, and South Asian communities. And we've seen that happen, of course, since 9/11 specifically. But what's really interesting, and I actually just looked up a couple of reports that were released by the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, is that white nationalist groups have actually been the ones to commit the most amount of domestic terrorist attacks since 2001. But yet at the same time, I'm seeing initiatives and tons of money being funneled through to surveil Muslim communities across the country that have actually not worked. I mean, in some cases, I'm not going to say that they haven't been able to identify one terrorist here or there. But I think what's really, really problematic is that we're using, and this goes to language as well, is that when we're speaking, we're using the word terrorist synonymous with Muslim. And so even yesterday, when the president was asked to condemn, you know, the attack itself as someone from a white nationalist group, he refused. He did not say that this person was actually a terrorist. He refused to use that word. And again, I think it comes from this ignorance, that terrorism is not synonymous with Muslim, and there can be other forms of terrorism. And I think one of the things that I saw as well, someone else had written it out, was that terrorism has no religion. But yet, with national security and policies, and even within, you know, whether it's state or federal, I constantly see even municipal law enforcement agencies constantly targeting Muslim communities in cases where they're trying to identify such attacks from happening, you know, being more proactive about it. But yet, we're not being able to stop any of these people from happening. And you would think that we would reconsider how it is we're approaching these issues, but we have not. And so I think I just want to acknowledge that it's really important to start to re-navigate those conversations and understand that what's been happening has actually not worked, and it's time to re-examine it.
But on the subject of looking directly at heads of state, let me read an email from a listener named Robert, who, if I think based on past emails, has self-identified as a Republican. Robert writes, "The Charlottesville terrorist mentioned Trump. The mail bomber terrorist mentioned Trump. The Pittsburgh synagogue terrorist mentioned Trump. The Coast Guard terrorist mentioned Trump. The New Zealand terrorist mentioned Trump. There are more incidents I could mention, but a pattern has been well established. You have the President of the United States inciting violence at rallies, at press conferences, and on the Internet. He never denounces these evil acts, or when he does, it's in the least sincere way possible. Stop ignoring the obvious and call it out for what it is. Trump," and Robert says, "the GOP are fine with these acts of terror, as these are their people." That's a strong statement from the emailer, but he says, "The panel says this evil act isn't surprising, and they're right. We are all in a cold civil war, and it's only going to get worse. Please tell me how I'm overreacting. Please say I'm just a snowflake. Go on, gloss over this like everyone else. This violence will continue, and it will only get worse. What can we do? I don't know all the answers, but let's start at the top." That's from Robert, a Republican. Go ahead.
I don't disagree with him. I do think Trump has been a problem. I'm not going to necessarily say that he hasn't been. Again, it goes back to what it is he's legitimizing and justifying. Even inciting violence, when he was, you know, when he was asked about the next year, right, the 2020 presidential candidates and people who are running for election against him, he's made these claims that if power is to be shifted, violence will be incited against Democrats. And, you know, as we're talking about who progressives are and all of these things, you know, what kind of president goes out and says something like that? I think it's really important to recognize, again, that he's trying to incite this sort of hate. And it comes from, again, I go back to what I acknowledged in the beginning of this segment, is that it comes from this fake crisis he continuously tries to establish and makes people worried. He's constantly making people worry that, you know, there's people coming in to try to take your jobs. You got to pay for their families and all these other things, when in reality, it's not how the system works. And so it's really important to recognize, again, and I think you were talking about the youth, and I think one of the most important things is being able to navigate the news and having a set of critical thinking, I think, is incredibly important, and being able to identify what is true and what is false. But it is very difficult, especially with the rise of information sharing, to identify specifically what is and what isn't true. And again, truth can also be incredibly subjective. And so I think it's just really important to recognize, how is it that we're actually identifying what is actually ongoing and what is the actual problem and what isn't?
Be encouraged, Evan. If a self-identified, like myself, please don't hate me, Republican, is saying to you and saying to the people that are listening that it is a Republican president or a Republican whatever that is fostering and encouraging and inflaming passions, ignorantly and erroneously, but whatever, I think you have, you know, example one in what I was saying. People ultimately think for themselves. They realize the issues that they're facing. They're educated, and they make a decision. At the end of the day, he's going to speak with the loudest voice he has, and that's his ballot. And if somebody sees this for what it is, or he talks to somebody and helps them see what it is, that'll change things on their own. There's always going to be either a fringe element on either side or an emboldened fringe that is going to think in a certain way. You're not going to get everybody. But with people realizing that there is an incitement to violence here or hate or whatever, and as a result, people are being pushed farther apart versus being brought together, you're going to have it. I mean, I take my hat off to the emailer, because he's said it, you know, probably a hell of a lot more plainly than the rest of us.
Oma?
I think I said it before when I was once before in this program, actually just reminded me of that, you know, racism, for example, used to be a terrible disease that you kind of hide. And it has been present in this country since the beginning of this country. But we just, you know, used to push it under the carpet and just kind of not talk about it. Unfortunately, what has, you know, someone like Trump has done is emboldened people to actually act on their feelings that they have had the whole time. It's not like they started becoming, you know, white supremacists when Trump became the president. But, you know, what you hear and what you what someone says matters. You know, I actually read somewhere this morning that Stephen King, who is also a Republican, I believe, from Iowa, actually was sharing things and saying that, you know, the United States should have another civil war. I mean, that's crazy. How can you be a leader, in the United States of America and actually make those kind of comments? And quite frankly, I am still to hear someone responding to that.
What Steve King, the congressman from Iowa, to be as accurate as I can be here, he shared a meme saying that if there were a modern-day civil war, the red states would have the advantage because we have trillions of bullets, and in the blue states, they don't even know what bathroom to use. That's a sitting member of Congress.
Exactly. So to say that words don't matter and to actually be surprised that we are seeing the stuff that's happening in this country is shocking to me, actually. If you're listening to anything that they're saying, how can you be surprised?
As we go to break, I want to encourage more of your feedback, listeners, and I'm going to read a more hopeful email here. Leslie writes to say, I'm a Protestant and I attended the service at the Islamic Center yesterday. I was so grateful to have the opportunity to hug these Muslim women and show them how much I care. It was a beautiful day. That's from Leslie. So let's not lose sight of that. I mean, our guests have said that what happened in Rochester yesterday with hundreds of people who are not Muslim coming out to the Islamic Center to show solidarity matters in a very powerful way. But we're also talking about what it means going forward and what we've learned from not just the terrorist attack in New Zealand, but sort of the state of the world today. So you just heard Alma Ulmer Hudzik, who is an activist and refugee from Bosnia. Iman Abid is an activist and Muslim American. Sarir Fazli, the past president of the Islamic Center of Rochester. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org.
I'm Megan Mack. Tuesday on The Next Connections, the local nonprofit group No One Left Behind is working with the interfaith community to help resettle refugees from Afghanistan and Iraq. These are refugees who have served in the U.S. military. We'll talk about their recent efforts and we'll hear from refugees. Then in our second hour, a local fatherhood conference is helping fathers address barriers to parenting. We'll hear from some of the participants. Talk to you Tuesday.
Connections continues here on WXXI. I'm Evan Dawson. And let me just read a note from a listener. Molly says, I didn't have a chance to attend yesterday, but what would your guests say I can do now to be a good ally going forward? It's a good question from Molly. I'll go around the table. Sarir?
Call the Islamic Center. See what it is that the center needs. See when there is a gathering or a get-together and hang out. I told all those students at that session that I did, I said, if you don't know anything about us, tap one of us on the shoulder. We're all over. You can identify us generally. And have a cup of coffee and have a chat. In things like this, if you don't know enough about me first, how are you going to be able to help me? You're not. That's what people do. They've come in, they've had conversations, we've talked, we've done whatever. And then somebody like Molly, they become the best ambassador because, you know, they've experienced us firsthand, we've had the conversation, and then they take it from there, and then they do it on their own.
Okay. Molly, there's one answer. Alma?
Come work with us. That's what I'm going to say. Come work with us. I'm involved with two organizations that I'm going to talk just shortly about. One is Baraka Muslim Charity that operates in the city of Rochester. They are involved in helping the most vulnerable people in our community. They're fighting poverty, they're fighting racism, and they're fighting Islamophobia all at the same place. Please come help us. The other place that I'm going to talk about is another initiative that is happening in Fairport is Learning Links of Fairport, where basically a group of volunteers is coming and tutoring kids in school subject, and most of these kids are actually from the Muslim community. They're from the immigrant or refugee community. So you have an amazing opportunity to actually introduce these kids to something that they have may not have seen in whenever whatever part of the world they're coming from, and that is love, and that everyone is equal in this country, and that we can still, you know, maybe disagree, but still, you know, like, have compassion for each other. So please check out organizations that are operating locally that actually and meet Muslims, and that's the best way to actually really fight the Islamophobia.
Imam.
I think I have a few things, but I think the first is invest resources in initiatives that actually want to have the conversation on things like diversity, equity, and inclusion. I think, you know, we are a part of a marginalized community that needs to be showing up at the table if they aren't at the table. You know, and I think acknowledging other issues like poverty and racism and other, you know, forms of xenophobia is really important. And we can do so through initiatives that combat those three principles. The second is, I think it's really important to condemn any sort of like negative rhetoric, and to do so in some of the most sensitive of places. So within your own home, if you hear, you know, your grandpa is calling someone out as a terrorist because, you know, all of a sudden they see someone in a hijab who is crying or something like that, and, you know, he says, "Oh, those terrorists," or something like that, condemn it. You know, try to not necessarily drop the conversation, but confront it and really try and, you know, try to change the rhetoric. You're right, Evan. It is harder for people who are older, for instance, to shift their mindsets. But I think it's never too late to try something with somebody. So I think it's really important to bring this sort of like sense of wanting to build solidarity within communities into your own home, because that's where these conversations need to begin. And we know that's where they are beginning. And the third, I think it's really important to also address, you know, if you're not surrounding yourself in a place where there are people who don't necessarily look like you, how will you ever learn otherwise? And so I say not only to the youth, because I think the youth are actually trying to do it in the community, and I commend the youth for doing it. But I think it's really important that if you are, for instance, living in a suburban town where people are predominantly white, go and actually try to put yourself in a place where there aren't as many people who look like you, and really try to live their lives. And what I mean by that is acknowledging their experiences, acknowledging what their lives are like. And you'll never be able to truly empathize unless you actually put yourself in those situations. And while at first it's uncomfortable, I mean, clearly there are two other people at the table here who are actually welcoming you into their space. And it's not just the Islamic Center. It's not just Barakah. You know, there are a number of organizations that will welcome you into their communities. And I think it's really important to do that.
All right. You want to add to that, Sarah?
You know, Ivan, as I was telling you earlier, I have to give a shameless shout out to the Pittsburgh varsity girls basketball team for their state championship victory.
It's like you have a child on the team.
I do. And I have to tell you, I experienced a weekend with a number of families who were out and about and celebrating and going through this ride. But when people see you and they know you're a Muslim, I had people say, "Hey, I'm sorry." And, you know, what happened or how can that be helped or whatever. It's as simple as my placing an order at a restaurant and asking the waitress or the waiter, "No bacon." And I get a few barbs thrown at me. But it sets a precedent that somebody realizes there's a difference here. What happened? You explain it. Boom. Problem solved. We move on. I may not do everything that I'm supposed to do. And then I try to explain it. But some things that stick out. I mean, my 16-year-old daughter, same thing. She has to do certain things, you know, like dietary, et cetera. And just having exposure to a large group of kids who experience that, "Hey, why don't you do this or why do you do that?" And you get them for a minute or 3 minutes or 5 minutes, it gives you an incredible opportunity to engage somebody who otherwise, like Iman said, may not be engaged or not realize it. And then a separate conversation happens.
All right, I want to grab another phone call, and this is Patty in Irondequoit next. Go ahead, Patty.
Hi, Evan. Yes, I have been listening since the start of the show, and I have to say my heart got heavier and heavier. It's just there's so much sadness now around all the hatred. But then you said, "Hey, well, there's got to be some good stuff out here. We know there is." And so that triggered me to call because I've been working or volunteering with a group called No One Left Behind for the last year or so. And as I was waiting on hold, the person who answers the phone says, apparently they're going to be on your show tomorrow. So I did not know that.
I thought you were a planted call.
No, not at all. But I was listening to this conversation, and I generally don't like speaking on the phone like this. But I too feel, what do I do? It's there's so much social media reaction, but the actual, how do we start to learn, understand, and work through this darkness? And so I, like many things, I just this opportunity presented itself. However, this is not about me. It's about the organization and the experiences that I've had in meeting mostly women, helping them navigate the medical system, and the stories of their beautiful lives and what they have given up to come here. Their families cooperated with our military in Afghanistan. They risked their lives for us. And it's just been a blessing to me, an absolute blessing. So there are ways to drop these barriers between us. And so I'm giving a shout out to No One Left Behind. So thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, Patty, thank you. And there are a number of organizations in our community that you can work with that help people in serious direct need. No One Left Behind, Mary's Place, there's a number that do great work. So there are opportunities there, and I do appreciate that, Patty. And so Patty is saying, that's one way. As Iman Abbott said, if you're sort of in a little bit of a bubble, and that's our world, find a way to sort of break out of that. So on that note, I want to ask all of our guests a question that came up when we had a conversation on this program just a few weeks ago with Sarir's successor, Tabassum Javed, who is the president of the Islamic Center of Rochester. We had a listener write in, and basically from her own view, a younger perspective, kind of challenge the president of the Islamic Center now, who was saying somewhat similar to what Sarir said, you take the opportunity, whether you're at a restaurant, you're ordering to educate about a difference here and there. This young woman wrote and said basically, like, look, as a young activist, it is not my job to always educate people who are ignorant. It would be exhausting to have to do that all the time. It is exhausting. And, I'm sorry, but I can't do that all the time. That's not fair to people who are in communities that have been oppressed. And that led to an interesting back and forth. And I think the president of the Islamic Center is certainly respectful and honored that viewpoint, but offered a bit of a different view. And I think it's asking a lot, Sarir, that if you're at a restaurant or wherever you are, you're constantly having to kind of be explaining differences. But I wonder how you feel about that.
I have to say, in my experience as an individual, not even in my involvement with the Islamic Center, but if I'm foreign, and foreign doesn't just mean my roots go overseas or whatever, but if I engage in some kind of behavior that is not considered so-called normal for someone who is with me, and they are inquiring as to why that is, I don't take it to be a burden upon myself. Whether I'm in a group of two or 200, whether you need a kosher or a halal meal, or you don't eat certain things, or whatever it is, it doesn't take much for me as an individual to say, this is why. And it starts a conversation. Maybe it's easier for me because I'm born and raised here. My social circle and other circles are very diverse. They're very different. And I may get the opportunity, even though I'm not looking for it, when somebody asks me, hey, why did you do this? Or why don't you do that? Or why don't you eat this or that? And I'm happy to do it because I know what my role is. And that is definitely my role. I want to be able to explain to somebody what the differences are and why. And after that, share the same damn meal with them. They're going to get it one way or the other, and it'll go on. But whether it's that cup of coffee or the sandwich or whatever, I'm not trying to place a burden upon anybody. The burden is more mine because mm-hmm. people want to know. But I am all about trying to show how my difference is a very subtle difference and how the heavy majority of what we are is very similar.
Okay. Iman, how do you feel about that?
I had a similar conversation with somebody who was actually African-American. I didn't want to put the burden on them to acknowledge, racism in America, for instance. And for someone who's going through such oppression, and I don't actually want to speak to that I've gone through such oppression in comparison to this individual, but there's different levels of oppression we go through. And so I think the burden that we carry is dependent on those experiences. And so for me, I'm similar to Sarir. I'm happy to acknowledge the questions. I'm happy to sit in a space and answer any questions that people may have. Actually, I encourage people asking the questions that may seem ignorant, because we're here. Some of us are here to respond to you about that. What becomes a little bit of an issue is when I'm acknowledging someone, and this has happened my whole life because I don't wear hijab. And so people are like, "You're really Muslim? Like, you don't wear hijab, but you're Muslim?" And I'm like, "Oh God, like, I'm telling you I'm Muslim. So it just just take it. Don't tell me that I'm not Muslim for not wearing hijab." Or, you know, for instance, if I'm out by myself and I'm like, "What? Like, who are you? You're not my father. You're not my grandpa. Like, why are you judging so hardcore?" And, you know, if I'm claiming to be Muslim, but acting a certain way aside from what people think Muslims are. But again, you know, I'm happy to have those conversations. It does let me know what level of ignorance people may have. But I think it's really important to try our best to answer any questions and to also just make ourselves available as a community to change that sort of perspective, because it's necessary.
Alma?
I hope I'm wrong, but that kind of comment, unfortunately, I think comes from privilege. And it's someone who did not have to explain themselves for anything ever. So then they don't feel that, you know, you should, you know, this is the kind of burden that I don't want on my shoulders. And, you know, in some ways I don't have it because, you know, I'm a white woman who doesn't wear hijab, who speaks with an Eastern European accent, who can blend. For the lack of better word,
passing is
and I have, yeah. You know, and I know as an immigrant, I have had much easier time dealing in this country because of the way I look. But you know, my daughter wears hijab, and she's clearly Muslim. You know, and I have to do that because I want to protect her, not because, you know, I want to carry this burden on my shoulders. I have to do it so that my daughter is actually not misunderstood, and that people accept her, you know, as part of the just, you know. I guess this country, and she's just part of this country, just like anyone else is.
Well, of course, and that's where the recent Pew research, Americans' views towards Americans who are not Muslim, their views towards people who are from the Islamic faith have gotten slowly warmer, but they still lag our views of people from other faiths. And frankly, the shocking statistic to me of all of them was that more than half of Americans in this country don't view Muslims as part of the mainstream. Well, the mainstream, I mean,
what is the mainstream?
It's just super white-centered, probably Christian-centered.
Exactly.
Is what that means.
What is the mainstream?
Yeah.
I don't think that, you know, I know that there's a mainstream, but there really is not mainstream in this country.
Yeah. So, I take the point. I think our guests have given us a lot to think about. And as we get down to our last few minutes here, I want to ask all of them, you know, if there is any part of you that feels a sense of optimism at all, at least seeing the outpouring of support post-New Zealand, is there a chance now to sort of build in a different direction, or are we at the sort of this dangerous precipice now? I mean, Aman, how is it hitting you? How are you feeling about that?
What hit me even more than the New Zealand incident was actually the incident that happened, I believe, I think it was an incident that happened in another mosque, but I can't remember where an individual was actually outside hammering individuals who were leaving the mosque. I don't know if anyone knows what I'm talking about, but he literally had a hammer and he was ready to literally physically hurt people as they were leaving the mosque at this point. He was hiding behind cars. And I said to myself, oh my goodness, if there's anybody who has not spoken up in between the time that the incident happened in Christchurch and then this incident happened, which only happened a few hours later, stand up, speak up, do it right now. And when I mean right now, I don't mean like take your time, take another day. It's because right now is the opportunity to stand up and show your solidarity for not only this community, but every other marginalized community. Because as long as we stand together, I don't think people understand the importance of like what I even witnessed at the ICR yesterday, where people were literally across faiths holding hands, saying different chants and worship, you know, prayers. And I said to myself, we're all praying under this one house because we're all the same. And it sounds so cliche as I say it back to myself, but I don't think people understand the importance of showing unity and solidarity and not taking the time anymore to take a position. So if you have been quiet, if you've only shared things on social media and you haven't actually taken a position on something else, you know, physically, I think it's really important to start to do that right right now, reach out to any one of us that are here. I mean, I'm opening the doors both up for Sarir and Alma, but they've made themselves available. But also anybody else. And, you know, ask us if there's anything else you can do. If you want us invited to the table, we're happy to do that. Again, I think it's just really important. We also, I just want to acknowledge, we're not truly all representative of the Muslim community. There are so many other voices and identities that are not here at the table. And so go out and explore and learn more about what it means to be Muslim and what it looks like to be Muslim and how we practice our faith if you are intrigued by it in any way. But I think it's just really important to not take any more time.
Iman's right, by the way. Everyone is familiar with what happened in Christchurch, New Zealand. The hammer-wielding attack happened in East London just several hours later and left at least one person with a head injury as the hammer-wielding people fled in the van. So amazing. Sarir, are you an optimist? 20 seconds.
Always. I have unbelievable faith in humanity. And if not, as we say, in our parents' generation, if not in mine, then definitely in the next, because things will get better.
Are you an optimist, Alma?
Absolutely. An attack was prevented in our local community towards the Islamberg community. So I think, and someone had to speak up to prevent that attack. I absolutely am. They're good people.
Well, see, that's an interesting perspective, because that, to the extent that brings you down, that anyone would even plan it, you're saying people are speaking up.
But someone stopped
it. They're calling
it
out. They're showing solidarity. Almer Hadzic, an activist and refugee from Bosnia, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Sarir Fazli, the past president of the Islamic Center of Rochester. Thank you, Sarir.
Thank you.
Iman Abed, who is an activist and a Muslim American. Thank you, Iman.
Thanks, Evan.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you're surrounded by love on this Monday afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.